Welcome, everyone. I hope you had a good lunch. I'm Jessica Reinisch at the History Department, and it's my pleasure to introduce this panel on Nazi-era boycotts. I think it's been the format to introduce all the speakers in the same go, and then we can move through the papers and save items of discussion and questions for right at the end. So our first speaker will be Christoph Kreuzmüller. He's coming from the Memorial House of the Wannsee Conference, where he's just completed, I think, an extensive project on the fate of Jewish-owned businesses in Berlin, 1930 to 1945. And he's written extensively on both Holocaust and economic history. Our second speaker will be Gideon Raveni from the University of Sussex, where he is reader in history and also director of the Center for German-Jewish Studies. His central research and teaching interests lie in social and cultural history of modern Jewish and European history. And I think he's currently working on a book-length project on consumer culture and the making of Jewish identity in Europe. And then finally, our third speaker will be Stephen Norwood from the University of Oklahoma, where he is professor of history and Judaic studies. He received his PhD from Columbia University and is author of at least five books on American history, including The Third Reich in the Ivory Tower, and most recently, Antisemitism and the American Far Left. So I will hand over to our first speaker, Christoph Kreuzmüller.
You know it's going to happen sooner or later, don't you?
We all went for food and
Thank you for the help. Thank you for the kind introduction and for the kind invitation. I'll be talking out on the question of whether the ban on Jewish-owned businesses in Nazi Germany was really a boycott. And as you can imagine, I think it wasn't, otherwise it would be a rather boring title. And of course, we have got a very difficult slot. I know that we have all eaten. And so we'll try and get through this panel with smiling faces. 20 minutes I got, so I have to start. Even though the Political Union of Liberal Jews in Germany, the Zentralverein, referred to, I quote, the rusty weapon of economic boycott as early as 1924, and Gideon will talk about that later, I know. And although the picketing of business regarded as being Jewish in Germany is included in nearly all encyclopedias as an example, standard example of a boycott, I want to argue in my paper that the Nazis actually abused the word for their purposes. I want to do that not just as a semantic thing, but rather to kind of explore the borders of this term boycott and to sharpen our perception. And of course, to sharpen the semantic approach we have and the intrinsic approach we have got as to which groups are boycotted and which groups and how groups are targeted and how much violence plays a role. I'll start my argument with an analysis of incidents that happened 75 years ago today in Berlin. And then I'll take a step further back to discuss occurrences in March and April 1933, especially with regards as how the businesses to be picketed were picked, and finally discuss which terms the contemporary agents and observers used. To start, on June 20th, 1938, the New York Times reported on recurring street violence against Jews in Berlin. I quote, "A daylight ride down Berlin's main shopping street today revealed 1,000 or more crudely decorated Jewish-owned shops and stores that had been victims of one of the most sinister, but also of one of the most clumsily executed anti-Jewish demonstrations undertaken in the German metropolis since the advent of the National Socialist regime." And I have got one photo taken by an by not Jewish Berliner who lived around the corner of this very shop. And I'll come back to that photograph a bit later. In her best-selling Blood and Banquets, Berlin Social Diary, the journalist Bella Fromm recalled an incident she had witnessed in June 1938 off the main shopping streets in a rather unfashionable quarter near the Alexanderplatz. I quote again. "We were just about to enter a tiny jewelry shop when a gang of youngsters in Hitler Youth uniforms smashed the shop window, stormed into the shop, brandishing butcher's knives, yelling, 'To hell with the Jewish rabble!' The smallest boy of the mob climbed inside the window and started his work of destruction by flinging everything he could grab into the street. Inside, the other boys broke glass shelves and counters, hurling alarm clocks, cheap silverware to their accomplices outside. A tiny shrimp of a boy crouched in a corner of the window, putting dozens of rings on his fingers, stuffing his pockets with wristwatches and bracelets. His uniform bulging with loot, he turned around, spat squarely into the shopkeeper's face and dashed off." End of quote. Reporting on these incidents, the SS pointed out on June 22nd that even some, I quote again, Aryan shop had been identified as Jewish and were consequently boycotted. Thus, by 1938 latest, the social practice of what the Nazis called boycott had come to include forced closing and even the plunder of shops. The SS report also reveals that it was still the local perpetrators who were deciding which enterprises were to be targeted, even though a legal definition had just been published. This, the third amendment to the citizenship law, released on June 16th in the German State Gazette, was the first public statement on which businesses were actually to be regarded as being Jewish. However, since we all know that since the destruction of Jewish commercial activity had begun before June 38, the question is how businesses had been singled out previously and which consequences this had. To answer this, we have to go back to the year 1933. As we all know, the ban of businesses in Berlin had not really been carefully planned. Even though violence against Jews had been common practice and anti-Jewish measures had been on the Nazis' mind map long before. Yet, in March 1933, Hitler reacted rather spontaneously to international press reports about the terror in Germany. On March 26th, he decided on a public campaign against Jews to keep his raging and not only siegestrunken, but really drunk stormtroopers off the street and off the violence for a while. Initially, his newly appointed Minister for Propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, claimed that this was to counter a boycott of German goods abroad. This is another example we can discuss about what you mentioned, Frank, yesterday, like who's the victim, who claims to be the victim. In this case, of course, the Nazis claimed themselves that they were. And it's rather telling that this narrative was changed a day later, claiming the measures were taken to counter the unjustified international press reports, the so-called atrocity propaganda. In so doing, the Nazi party took the Jews in Germany as hostages to try to enforce a more positive international press coverage about their own persecution. And this is a very typical photo. It's from a series taken by an SA man. It's part of a series of three photos, and you can see like nice young SA man standing very peacefully in front of a shop, holding, and that's typical for Berlin, two like bilingual posters, because they're addressing the world in a way, showing like, hey, you know, we are nice boys and we're only passive and just standing there as pickets. And the interesting thing is that the photograph was taken with a flashlight, as you can all see. And of course, you can all see that a dog left his mark.
There.
And German dogs don't like pee on houses like at daytime. So the photo was actually taken the day on the night before the actual thing the Nazis referred to as boycott, in order to have a photograph ready then to publish, to influence the world as such. Okay, this aside, Julius Streicher editor of the notorious anti-Semitic weekly Der Stürmer, was appointed head of, I quote, the Central Committee Against Atrocity Propaganda and Boycott Baiting. So he's not head of the boycott committee, but the committee against the boycott baiting. He still organized the campaign on behalf of the Nazi Party. In his proclamation issued on March 29th, Streicher made it very clear he wanted, I quote, baptized businessmen or dissidents of the Jewish race, end of quote, to be targeted. Yet Streicher neither explained whom he actually regarded as being of whatever that might be, Jewish race, nor what to do with companies run by more than one owner. This was left to the discretion of the local stormtroopers and the committees set up in all the regional party branches, the so-called Gauer. Since they only had 2 days now to organize the what they refer to often to as the Judenaktion, the action against Jews or Jewish action, in cities like Berlin, the organizers did not have time to thoroughly classify businesses, even if there had been a coherent category. Instead, they reverted to the simplest method of all, checking names. Thus, businesses run under names which the local perpetrators believed to be hinting a, whatever that might be, Jewish background, were targeted. In her New York exile, Eleonora von Mendelssohn, herself a third-generation Protestant, summed up this attribution automatism by saying, I quote, one cannot be called Mendelssohn and not be Jewish, end of quote. This is, by the by, one of the reasons why on April 1st, really a lot of photographers gathered in front of the En Israel department store, because they seemingly expected a certain photo opportunity. And even this photo published of En Israel in the Petit Dauphin Noir. It's like the furthest backwater French paper I could think of. Even they published a photograph of En Israel department store, because okay, they always thought, okay, Israel will be targeted. So if I go there, I can shoot a photo. In November 37, the SS-owned weekly Das Schwarze Korps ran a revealing correction to a report it had published some weeks earlier about the flourishing trade in Hitler postage stamps. Having referred to, I quote again, Levi's, Salomon's and Goodman's who had once again spotted a business opportunity, end of quote, it was forced to concede. As it happens, there is indeed a postage stamp wholesale in Hamburg we were not familiar with, called Paul Goodman, who is a party member, i.e. of the Nazi party and thus could not be Jewish. We were, of course, not referring to him in our remarks, which were general comments relating solely to Jewish traders, end of quote. How devastating the simplifying name-race equation worked is shown by the fact that in Berlin, those companies trading under the name Mendelssohn were forced into liquidation a lot earlier than companies with less, say, conspicuous names. To counter the attribution automatism, many Jewish-owned companies changed their names, the names of the distribution especially. The butter wholesaler Weinberg Brothers bought a company called Müller & Braun to trade under, and Israel started using delivery trucks on which the name of the company had been blanked. Some well-known shops, however, with a large clientele, relied on the fact that no one could really keep track of their customers in the busy high streets of the German metropolis. Reporting on the summer sale 1938, the New York Times headlined, I quote, Berlin housewives storm sales in stores of Jews, end of quote. The presence of the international press actually protected the Jewish-owned businesses in Berlin. One example, in summer of 1935, the press reports led to an end of the riots on the streets of Berlin, and the riots were referred to as boycotts again by the Nazis themselves. Since Berlin offered many opportunities for the Jewish community finding assistance, including a stable support network and Jewish cooperatives we talked about yesterday, foreign embassies in easy reach, it was regarded as a safe haven for businessmen from smaller towns where the pressure was a lot higher and much more devastating. Oh dear. it's going to explode in a minute, but I'll just keep on talking. This in turn led to a, like the pressure in the smaller places led to a substantial influx of new companies to Berlin, so that the number of businesses hardly shrank between 33 and some of 38. When a regional party economic commissioner stated that there were still more than 46,000 Jewish companies in the German capital. To put the pressure up, Goebbels ordered his stormtroopers to systematically smear shop windows and cause the scenes I presented in my introduction. Now I want to click this away and go on. And this photo I have shown, it is quite interesting because you can see quite a few things. First of all, you can see the smearing, like with of people who have had letters. Could reach up to this, you know, to the first floor, so they knew that the police wouldn't interfere, because otherwise, like you know, it's not a quick action if you take letters and they had all the time in the world. And all these horrible inscription I'm not going to translate. The other thing I think is quite interesting, that you can see that the name of the company is missing. Yeah. But what is left is the German umlaut. It's the Berliner I Möbelhaus Julius Kohn Möbel. Since Julius Kohn obviously expected, since he was called Kohn, to be targeted, he seemingly took his name off the street in June in order to protect himself. And you can see in the shop window, he's still selling chairs in the lot. So the business was only liquidated a lot later, so he's really trying to protect himself. And this is the this is kind of, so to speak, mirroring the attribution mechanism I was talking about. So you try to protect in not being called Kohn, so at least not in big writing when the SA came along and threatened you. While the New York Times reported that the attitude of the spectators was distinctly one of, I quote, unexpressed disapproval, whatever that might be, the SS stated that some non-Jewish Berliners asked whether, I quote, the government in its sixth year really needed to fall back onto propaganda methods used in the Juden boycott on April 1st, 1933, end of quote. Whether the destruction of Jewish commercial activity was a boycott was seemingly an uneasy question in Germany at the time. It is true, all German papers reported on the boycott and headline boycott in April 33. But those papers had just lost their independence and also claimed, against their better knowledge, that the whole thing had been very peaceful. The SS, as we have seen, tried to enforce the use of the word, but would sometimes write Judenaktion. I try to translate this word, it's really difficult. Jewish action, whatever that is. In internal reports, whereas in the files of the Reich Ministry for Economics, one finds even find the term closure of Jewish shops, referring to April 33, which is much more precise in a way. In his study on the law of competition, the rather courageous lawyer Eduard Reimer stated in 35 and published in Germany in 35 that, I quote, the economic boycotts were a cancerous growth, end of quote, and that the anti-Semitic boycott was, and I quote again, unethical, sittenwidrig, because it asked for something impossible, quote, a change of race, which is not possible. The Schwarze Corps fiercely attacked the book, which was taken off the shelves and pulped shortly afterwards. Only three copies of the 1935 edition survive in public libraries in Germany. In his dissertation on boycott and collective boycott in international law, published in 1935 in Germany, Gerhard Runthe was much more conformist and somehow managed to avoid that question, even though the book title asked for a definition. So did the well-known Meyer's Encyclopedia, published in 1937. The editorial board merely defined boycott as a political or economic means of enforcement and mentioned Charles Boycott, yes, the English labeling system, and the boycott of Germany by, I quote, world Jewry, but not the picketing of Jewish shops in April 1933. Outside Germany, the line was seemingly drawn between violent and non-violent action taken. Thus, on June 17, 1938, when reporting on the Third Amendment of the Reich Citizenship Law, defining Jewish businesses, the New York Times headlined, "Boycott of Jews." One day later, June 18th, when focusing on the ongoing violence, the headline ran, "Anti-Jewish Raids." If we take violence to be the dividing line, I'm sure we would all agree that the pogrom-like race riot of June 38 was not a boycott. What about 33, though? Well, as Michael Wild has pointed out, I quote him, "The whole boycott campaign between 1933 and 38 was an arena of collective violence against Jews in Germany," end of quote. Although Goebbels claimed that the picketing of shops happened in a strictly disciplined way, there was violence. This can even be seen in a German newsreel, and this is the reason why I got this whole thing. I hope it works now. Probably doesn't, huh? Oh, yeah. Hang on. It's a very short film.
Into the enable content. It's
boycotting.
Yeah.
Yeah, get back into the slide.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, yeah, of course, if you'd.
Do you have to get it back into the slideshow?
And now look at him. Could you see that? Probably couldn't. Should I do it? Okay.
There's the same man standing here, and he comes towards the camera, and then the film cuts off.
So what you can see is it's the official German newsreel. It's official photographing. The SA man sees the camera, goes towards the camera, and shakes it off. You can see the aggression. Now you can say, okay, he didn't want to be taken photograph of because he thought he was not eye candy. But there's many more incidents of massive violence happening. I understand a boycott to be a non-violent ban punishing misconduct or asking for political or economic change. As neither was at stake after 33 and in 33, and the incidents extremely violent, it seems to me that calling the racist blockade of Jewish shops a boycott was yet another clever PR trick of Goebbels, selling the start of systematic persecution of Jews in Germany to the world as a not unusual measure in a rather normal political struggle. Like so many other contemporary words like Kristallnacht or Aryanization, boycott masked the violence that came as part and parcel of the persecution of Jews and the destruction of Jewish commercial activity in Germany. Like David asked whether like terms make a difference, and I would think, yeah, they do, because they shape our perception. And they can sell. In retrospect, Alfred Wiener, living around the corner, by the way, one of the Centerverein's leading figures then in 33, wrote in 1958 that the April boycott in 33, he called it April boycott, was merely, I quote him, a boycott of law and the writing on the wall. As it was, the events the Nazis referred to as a boycott were in fact counterproductive. They aimed to drive the Jews out of Germany by destroying their livelihood. In so doing, however, many Jewish families were stripped of the necessary means to emigrate. In the end, the vicious circle of emigration and robbing led to the forced emigration and to the rise of a former Standard Oil representative called Adolf Eichmann. This is a different story. Last remark. Frank asked what about the role of state? The boycott, the thing that Nazis referred to as boycott in April 33 was not organized by the government yet, but by the Nazi party. In April 33, the SA, who stood picket, was auxiliary police. So, in a way, part and parcel of the regime. So you really have a very near, if not a state-ordered measure here. And talking about the vacuum, I was thinking, It's not a vacuum of sovereignty, of course, we're talking about here, but a vacuum in where the collapse basically of the legal system allows these measures or these benevolent measures to be taken. So to speak, when the legal system went, the law was boycotted, behemoth came creeping in. Thank you very much for your attention.